Hi, Eric. Thank you for having me. My name is Samuel Tayengwa. I head product and analytics for our markets outside of South Africa for TransUnion Information Credit Bureau.
TransUnion recently released a report around the Kenya Markets Insight Report. Basically, from as an introduction, you can take us through what TransUnion has put through this report together. And is there a specific reason it was launched during this period?
Thank you, Eric. I think it's important to maybe just give the synopsis of what the report is really about. So the Kenya Market Analytics Report provides a comprehensive view of the credit landscape and a detailed analysis or a deep dive analysis of the market trends, looking at also opportunities and risks. And I think it's important that our audience also understand that everyone is keen to understand where the market is going, considering the current situation that we find ourselves in. Also, another reason was for us to really position ourselves as thought leadership in the lending institutions that we work with. I mean, we work within an ecosystem, and we wanted our clients to have a bit of in-depth understanding of, you know, product preference, what's happening there, what's happening with the demand for credit with their own customers, and where are potential risks and alignments in as far as, you know, different product strategies are concerned within their own spaces. So it was a case of putting together something that would assist our customers to have information at their fingertips, but also understand the market from an overview point of view.
Interesting. From the report, we noticed a few trends that were a bit, some were there around Q4, some were there, and some then came about around Q1 with regards to demand for credit in the banking sector, but particularly the mobile loans. Give us your views. What are some of the trends that you witnessed during these two periods?
I think what is interesting to note is the demand for credit will always be there, considering that Kenya is a credit market, right? So the demand for credit will always be there. But what we saw coming out of a Q4 2019 into Q1 2020 was, though we saw a 4.8 increase in mobile loans, in as far as the demand for mobile loans is concerned, there was an increase of 4.8. But if you want to do an averaging out of that type of demand, we saw a decline in what we call new business to, you know, new business or new openings or new accounts, in as far as new to credit customers are concerned. So we saw a decline in that respect. And then what we also observed was that it could have been an issue of banks themselves trying to retain and have more liquidity on their side, maintain high levels of liquidity. You are aware that we are coming out of Q4 where the interest rate was just repealed, and banks are now starting to do what we call risk-based pricing, which is also new to them, right? Most of them are trying to find their fit in as far as this new scoring model is concerned. The Central Bank of Kenya is pushing for banks to have this type of model embedded in their scoring models. And that also has in itself created a relaxed approach from the financial institutions to drive lending. Bear in mind that the banks have a bigger chunk of the pie when it comes to mobile lending, right? About 90%, 92% in as far as that business is concerned. So we saw a drop in a drive to offer a lot of mobile lending or mobile loans between Q1 and Q4 2019.
Okay, interesting to note that banks drive some of the largest transactions with regards to mobile lending, and they control actually a very, very big market. Given that from the report, demand for credit fell and banks weren't really willing to lend, what do you think could be the reason behind this trend?
I'll expand it in the sense that, look, with the interest rate kept being repealed, right? So Remember, with whilst the interest was capped, banks could lend at that flat interest and they knew they would make their money, etc. And when the interest was repealed and now banks had to lend in relation to a risk-based model, it became a bit of an enchanted space for most of the banks. Look, we talk to most of them day in, day out. Most of them are still trying to look at what is the best risk-based model. Some of them are working with other institutions that specialize in that type of pricing approach. And it's all because everybody's trying to figure out how do we price. And whilst we are there, the first reports of COVID are reported in Nairobi and I think around April. So there's been a fruit basket of how financial institutions have had to retain liquidity, like I said earlier on, that to maintain high levels of liquidity as a way to mitigate potential or future losses that could happen or could be as a result of the current situation that we also find ourselves in. By virtue of the interest rate being repealed, we also don't know how the market was going to move in as far as the risk of lending goes. And now, secondly, with COVID coming in, we also don't know how consumers who have still maintained obligations to pay their loans, how will that play out? So banks have had to sort of be more conservative in their lending criteria. We have seen that most of them have actually maintained lending within their existing base, but not necessarily new to lending or new to credit type of customers. So it's pretty much banks are trying to understand what risks sit out there. And that's why you find with our report coming in, we are trying to open those pockets for them. We're trying to show them sort of, you know, a navigated approach of this is how the market is looking. This is where the market is going. As we will move into Q2 report, we're going to show the impact, but now giving a reference of where we kicked off from, and now they'll be in a more better position to make better informed decision, even if it means opening up now more credit to the different demographic and different pockets of the community.
Okay, interesting. Something quite insightful, given that I think the rate cap was repealed around Q4 of last year. And you know, what the market expected is that if the rate cap has been repealed, then in terms of business inquiries and loans, business loans, particularly for SMEs, that should go up. But then given, I think, what happened from our conversation is that now when this crisis came on board, that really even affected, because the banks even said they just want to remain liquid. One of the things from the report that was also a big one was around a significant rise in the number of loan defaults or the non-performing loans. From the report, what's basically driving this? Could you just explain just that this general term of a very significant increase in number of defaults and NPLs?
So look, I think what's important to understand is what is driving, you know, NPLs, right? Let's take a step back and say the average market, without creating a panic, right, without creating a storm out of this, is the average market NPL sits at about 12.7, 12.8. That's the average market NPL, right? And the central bank monitors this because that informs whether our market is performing or not, and that informs whether the banks are lending to deserving customers or not, and are they reckless in their lending or not, you know, and also equally banks, how is their risk appetite in as far as that goes. What is important is when we look at default in as far as NPLs are concerned, is we want to also just spread it in accordance to product lines, because when you do that, you are better informed to see which product line is driving the highest NPL, right? There are product lines where we talk of secured lending. You know, when you talk of asset financing, when you talk of mortgages, there's a bit of secured lending in that respect because banks can retain collateral. But when you go to things like mobile lending, it's a secured form of lending. And we have seen that if you look at demographic type of behavior or demographic type of performance, your mobile lending tends to have the higher end of what we call high risk type of scoring. If you do your risk distribution on demographic borrowing patterns, you see that your Gen Z which is the new to credit, tend to be the highest defaulters. I mean, these are guys that are coming out of college. They are fresh to this credit spend. Maybe they just want to have a quick a loan from one of the financial institutions, but then they don't pay. They don't understand the impact of not paying back their obligations. So you'd find that also the reason why we saw a high rate of peak in Q1 was, you know, with lending, you also need to look into seasonality, right? So people are coming out of December, festive season. There's a big chunk of borrowing. But as we go towards the end of Q1, which is March data, we monitored that the rate of default also peaked in mobile lending because now people don't have money or have used up all their facilities, etc. So it's important to see that when we talk of that, we specifically want to separate other product lines because it's not every product line that was driving the highest levels of NPL in the market. I'm not sure if that is that answers the question. Yeah,
that answers the question very well. Something that I think that stood out for me was generally, I think you mentioned around the increase in number of total loan accounts increased by massively by around, I think, 21%. In from Q4 to around Q1, but then on the other hand, the number of business loans actually dropped.
Yeah,
which is quite which brings me to the question around in terms of this the increase or the defaults. Could we say which just given particularly from a local perspective? Which segment of the financial services industry? So be it fintechs, banks, where were most of these defaults probably occurred?
Interesting. That's a good question. So maybe let me start by clarifying when we talk of new accounts, right? When we say we had a 21% increase in new accounts. So what that basically means is Eric, who had 5 accounts, opened 3 more accounts, okay. All right? So it could also imply that we are also it could mean a couple of things. Our consumers are probably getting to be more heavily indebted. So they are looking for more sources of credit to sustain their lives, right? Or their livelihoods. So we saw more accounts per individuals being opened. So that's why there's that sharp increase of from 108 to 131. It means that one person increased their account. So you could on average have one person holding more than on average about 10 or 11 accounts. And the question that you also then brought is, as a result of that, Sam, could that mean then that we are the drivers of NPOs or defaulting accounts in the market, where could that be coming from? And I mean, obviously the financial sector be heavily regulated as it is, you'd realize that our fintech space, right, they were not predominantly heavily regulated, right? The banking side of it is heavily regulated, though the banks control about 90% of the fintech transactions, but the other almost 8% or so, 10% is non-regulated type of fintech lending. So you'd realize that because of that, they would lend, across the spectrum. And you then have Sam who took a loan with this other fintech, takes a loan with another fintech, and we would be encouraging our fintech clients to even inquire from TransUnion or other players in the market to check to ensure that the person that they're extending a credit facility to does not have similar facilities across the market, because then that resulted in either even elements of fraud where we have persistence, people just taking loans from different fintech players and never pay them back. That in itself would increase the rate of default. So it's important to understand how the fintech players would start to manage and monitor the risk of extended lending to the customers or to the market without having information at their fingertips to understand how these customers actually sit across the spectrum.
Okay, interesting. Speaking of fintech, locally, some news that has been running over the last few days is that our central bank has actually drafted some rules to regulate the non-bank digital lenders. Just curious to know how that will play out. No one knows how it will play out, but I think hopefully that can help some of the fintech lenders probably reduce that rate of NPLs. And
absolutely.
Looking at the report, the fintech or the non-bank digital lenders actually had, I think they had the highest rate of default.
Non-performing. Yeah. I mean, to actually quantify it, Eric, if you look at it, right, like I said, the banks control about 90% old transactions of what we call mobile lending, right? And the fintechs, which are also big in there. But if you look from a non-performing accounts by volume, just by volume, not by value, because by value, I mean, banks have capacity to lend more, but by volume, fintechs had about 38% of non-performing compared to their banking counterparts, we had 7%. Because by nature, yeah, banks are regulated. So banks have to inquire or check what we call, they have to reference the credit bureau. They have to check with the credit bureau. Some of the fintechs would probably check maybe just as a way to ensure that the ID is reflective on the bureau, but not as a risk mitigating factor. You understand? Yeah. So that in itself is worrying. I mean, if you look at the banks, only 7% were non-performing compared to fintechs with 38%. Right, whereas banks control 90% of the mobile transactions, so in itself, it's very concerning that the rate of non-performance by volume for fintechs is that high. If you then go to value, where we talk of account balance, so you know, the value of, or the money that is not paid back to the fintechs that we have seen as reported to us. I mean, from a value point of view, banks are sitting at about 50% compared to their performing ratios, but fintechs, still worrying, they're sitting with 60% higher values. Wow. Of non-performance on their base. So it's a serious issue that, you know, and I'm glad you mentioned that CBK is looking into a regulatory aspect to onboard fintechs into that framework, because then in itself, it could start helping to mitigate some of these issues that we are seeing being perpetuated in the market.
Interesting. I think that's actually a discussion around data and given that, as you've mentioned, the non-bank digital lenders, it's so much easier for them to approve credit, given that how determine their risk profile. I think that brings me to a question around optimization of data, and given what the current the pandemic has put a lot of pressure on both businesses and even households, and we are even and as we get along trying to get out of this this period, I'm just curious to know. How can businesses probably optimize data and information that they have on their customers to remain competitive and probably structure products much better?
Great question, Eric. I think let's probably address it by saying, what is the value of data, right? So data in its static form might not necessarily, you know, be as powerful than when it is translated into insights, which then makes smart views for businesses to make better strategic decisions. Data in itself can be built into what we call scorecards. So what we tend to advise our clients, because most of them have got what they call internal scorecards. So this is a modeling scorecard that is built upon, looking into historical data in terms of historical performance of their customers. And they build a scorecard that looks into risk parameters and risk measurements. And we at TransUnion, we also have our own scorecard that we give to banks and we give to institutions to use, because we have a generic view of the market. Banks have got their own customer view. We have a generic view. So they need to start looking into whether optimizing their internal scorecards, right? Because of new data that is coming through, because of the new trends of performance and behavioral changes in the market, there's a need to either, you know, recalibrate existing scores, right? Some of the scores could have been built 2-3 years ago. It's an encouragement that institutions need to really look into, you know, recalibrating their scores. They can come to organizations like ours for even validations of their existing scorecards and work with our own scorecards to ensure that they have better risk measurement tools in their space. I think also, you know, using data to start thinking more about products. How do you design products based on demographic buying behavior. I mean, what if we are to look at what COVID has done, you know, we have different generations that have different buying behavior. So the Gen Z, which is the new to credit, they have a way of wanting to consume products different to your baby boomers. So how can data inform your product design? How can data inform your product conceptualization based on what the market position is? At TransUnion, we talk a lot more about what is the market truth versus what is the response that we can give there. There is a voice of the customer out there, and if institutions look into data, data tells a story. Data tells a story, and if you trace it, at each point you pick up information that is important for you to make a concession or a decision on. So we would like to encourage organizations to use their internal and external data. Look for data outside your own ecosystem or your own environment that can start informing your own strategies. Looking at automated decisions, it's going to be important for them to start looking at automated decisions, but automated decisions are just systems that needs to be, are systems that will work even more with better data infused or integrated into them. So in itself, it will start helping organizations to, you know, to have better view of their customer, better view of, you know, the risk that they're dealing with, but more so even onboarding their customers efficiently, effectively, and seamlessly. So data can be very integral and can be a very key tool for these organizations to start playing around with, to start using in their, you know, end-to-end customer journey and decisioning.
Interesting, quite interesting. So during this period, we've seen a rise of usage in terms of basically internet banking, or basically people transacting online rather than the traditional form of banking. And one of the challenges that this brings is around risks around fraud and all that. And from the report, I saw something around USD 130 million of losses due to fraud. And I think this likely to go up given the period as consumers especially move digitally. Just curious to know, how can businesses protect themselves by extension, even their own customers?
It's a good question, right? I think what our listeners need to understand is what could be causing this, right? We are in a period where digital transformation has become the theme, or has become a buzzword because of what the COVID has done. COVID has created the need for contactless engagement with customers. Banks that believed in branch networks are starting to see that they will be left behind if they don't drive digital transformation in as far as extending their products are concerned. And in itself, digital transactions creates opportunities for fraud. Like you said, you know, there's a massive risk for fraud in as far as how customers engage with their institutions or with their banks. There's always chances that come in. You know we have syndicates that try to use people's ID. So we have a lot of customers that have come even to our organizations with their IDs having been stolen, and somebody going out to open an account, somebody going to take a loan on that ID. We have a lot of phishing that happens on the internet, you know, people being sold things that don't exist, people being asked for their passwords. So it's important for institutions to start realizing that their customers will need them to protect them from such type of unforeseen behaviors from fraudsters, right? So we encourage them to start building what we call authentication layers. You can still be as effective and efficient and still seamless in your onboarding or engagement with your clients from a user experience or user journey, but still retaining some level of authentication, be it identity solutions that like some TransUnion with identity fraud solutions where we can tell you who the person you're engaging with is. We have ways and means to, you know, to look into the input data that has flown into us, and we can almost give you an indicator to say there is suspicious transaction or suspicious behavior on this inquiry. And by so doing, they can also, you know, engage with their respective customer on their end. We also have information on what we call device information, because at the end of the day, you're trying to find identity in as far as the individual as well as the device, because that's where most of that fraud happens. Someone using someone's information or using a device to get someone's information. At TransUnion, we have what we call iovation.